I'm John Lewis, and you're listening to 360 Degree City, a podcast where we talk to all kinds of folks who are making life in cities better. Our hope is that by the end of each episode, you'll start to see your own city from a slightly different angle. The relationship between urban design and health is a fascinating one. Today, we're going to continue the conversation about this relationship between our built environment and our well-being. Today's guest is Jenny Rowe.
Hello, I'm Jenny Rowe. I direct the Center for Design and Health in the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. And I'm an environmental psychologist. And what that means is I study how people interact with their world and how that world impacts their health and well-being and behaviors. So Winston Churchill famously said, "Architects, designers shape the world and the world shapes us." I'm interested in that interaction between people and their world.
In this episode, we bounce through a number of concepts, including how digital technology, car-oriented planning, green spaces, and fascinating buildings are related to our health and well-being. Let's dive in. We'll dig into your insights and your research and some of the great lessons that you've pulled from that research. But one of the things I wanted to start with was perhaps if you could describe your process, so the how you understand the relationship between health and well-being and the physical environments. Could you maybe talk about some of your methods and how you go about finding out your findings?
Of course. First of all, I should say everything we do is grounded in theory from environmental psychology. I won't go into that theory, but we draw very heavily on what's come before us to design new experiments. So I use a lot of theory from restorative environment theory, which shows how certain environments have very positive effects for our well-being. So we use a range of methods. Most obvious method we use is observation. We actually watch what people do in their world and how they interact with both the physical objects in their world, with other people. And that could also include how they interact with virtual reality and the web and social media. So we look and see what people are doing. And again, we have strong theoretical models for doing that. We use a lot of self-report measures. We ask people how various spaces make them feel. And we use tried and tested psychological scales for that. I think it's really important that we understand how people feel subjectively. But then the big trend in my research in the last, say, 8 years has been the growth of what I call mobile health sensors that allow us to capture real-time, say, real-time stress responses as people interact with their world in real time. Now, this is a revolution because a lot of the work up until now, it still continues actually, in laboratories, largely in student populations. So the evidence has grown through this lab work in student populations, but actually the mobile health sensors now mean that we can really do the work in other populations out there in real time in the everyday world. So that's been a big revolution in the kind of paradigms associated with environmental psychology.
Right. Okay. And so when you're talking about mobile health sensors, are we talking about things like Fitbits and Apple Watches and things like that?
So we use a range of techniques. So we've done work with mobile EEG, which captures brain activity whilst we move through our environments. We capture heart rate variability. That's an indicator of your stress response as you move through the environment. We can use watches. We use other watches to capture your exposure to daylight. We can capture things like skin conductance, electrodermal activity, which all are triggers and signs of people's emotional activity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, terrific. Yeah, as you said, I imagine we could spend another a separate podcast or two or three getting into the theoretical backing and things like that. But maybe we'll if we can get some links from you, we can put it on the website and in the show notes and things. So if people want to dig in deeper on that, then they can go explore for themselves.
Okay, so one of the things I wanted to explore, oftentimes when people talk about, you know, the healthy parts of cities, the green space often comes up. Can you maybe speak to the impact that you've observed that green space has on the health and well-being of city dwellers?
So it has a range of impacts. It impacts people's levels of mental well-being. That's what I specialize in. So we have seen powerful effects of quantity of green space and access to green space on people's stress physiology and their self-report perceptions of stress, their general overall well-being. So that's what I specialize in. Other people also have identified physical health improvements of access to urban parks, to walkable communities. So communities that have street trees and green space and urban parks are defined as more walkable, i.e. the environment is more favorable to promoting walking and cycling. And that in turn, getting more people out on the streets has a social health implication. So if you have a nice neighborhood, if you have a neighborhood with nice front gardens, a wealth of street trees, you're more likely to walk in it. And as you walk, you're more likely to have kind of impromptu conversations with your neighborhood. So a neighbor. So it can build social cohesion and social capital of a neighborhood. I'd say that research is fairly slow to grow. We're beginning to look at it now. But the mental health benefits are really quite significant. It can improve your mood. It can improve depression. There's research that's shown a link between street trees and lower prescription rates of antidepressants. And it can also improve your cognitive performance, your functioning, your ability to be productive.
Okay. That's a pretty profound impacts from the built environment perspective. Are there other I guess design elements or design moves beyond kind of the green elements that have positive health impacts in how cities are built?
So that's a really good question. And we have to go back to restorative environment theory to help explain that. So the theory posits there are four attributes of the physical environment that promote psychological restoration and well-being. And one of them is fascination. The fascination is another word for curiosity, engagement in your environment. It doesn't necessarily need to be green space. It could be an aquarium or an art gallery or a facade of inherent historical or modern architectural interest. So restorative environments don't necessarily need to be green. They've been studied largely because green space has been found to have this component. The other three components, I'll just mention them really quickly, are this environment has to promote a sense of being away, a sense of escape, a sense of extent, which means it provides access to a whole other world. It might take you to some other place in your mind and your imagination. And compatibility, that world has to fit with what you want to do there.
Okay. Just to dig into the away or the escape aspect of it, what does that refer to? I mean, escape or away from what? Is that it just sort of the daily doldrums or?
So, yeah, the daily doldrums. You and I are both sat at our desks at the moment. I'm very fortunate and I have a view of green space. I don't know what you're looking at. But what we have to do, or what happens over the course of a day is we become cognitively depleted by all the tasks on our screen, the phone going, the emails. Actually just getting up and looking at a natural landscape that has these components takes us away from our, you know, the world that's depleting our energies.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. It's interesting of, you know, I've observed certainly in where we are in Calgary that, and just broadly, it seems that the conversation about cities, over the past few generations has been more, Let's create great places to live. Whereas prior, you know, when we were building freeways through everything, the city was a problem to be solved. And so nature was an escape from it. So it seems that the conversation about cities has shifted to a more positive realm, or more positive focus, I guess, and solution focused instead of let's just fix this terrible thing that we're stuck with. There's a little bit, it seems, to what you're saying, that there is still a need, perhaps even in well-designed environments, to have a bit of an escape from the cityness of a city. Is that fair to say?
I completely endorse that, and the research endorses it. So temporary respite from your everyday demanding environment. And I would make a case for these being really easily accessible. So it's great that, you know, Manhattan has this wonderful Central Park, but only so many people on its perimeter can access it. When I go to New York, I often think, oh, I wish Olmsted had distributed this green space a little bit more evenly through Manhattan so that other people could have a little chunk of it, you know, to get away from their office or from their apartment on a more regular basis.
Yeah, for sure. And it's that bit of access. Yeah, I have the same feeling when I'm in New York, and it's sort of I'm of two minds, I guess. The first is what you just described, and the other is in the absence of that, thank goodness for the life of this city that this massive single park exists.
Yes, I know. I have contrary feelings about it too, because it is spectacular.
Yeah. Along the back to the fascination and curiosity piece of the puzzle, recently I've been digging into in our company and with me myself how we work and just the role that technology plays and those kinds of things. One of the concepts that's come across my own consciousness recently is this idea of novelty bias, I've heard it described as. So the fact that the brain, you know, will jump at something that's new and novel, and in the context of how we work, that relates to Twitter notifications and your email pinging you that you've got a new message. Is that the same, I guess, function or part of the brain that relates to the fascination piece of how we understand our urban environment?
Well, it's kind of the opposite, because what all that social media does is deplete our cognitive resources. Okay. Fascination is a means of recovering that depletion and that depleted resource, because fascinating environments grab our attention in an involuntary way. It doesn't demand a lot of energy from us, whereas the constant pinging of texts and Twitter demands our cognitive attention in a quite dramatic way. And there's a very interesting study by William Sullivan around about how walking with your phone outdoors actually interferes with the benefits you could be accruing from engaging with that environment if you're also interacting with your phone.
Okay. Yeah, there seems to be this mounting mountain of evidence that these phones and these technologies, while they have some positive impacts, if left unchecked, they can have some pretty significantly negative impacts on our lives and our brains. We recently saw a study. I can't remember the exact details, but it was something along the lines of if you have your email on and you're getting pinged every 90 seconds, cognitively that's the equivalent of drinking a bunch of alcohol or smoking a bunch of weed in terms of the function of your brain power. And for folks that work in the do thinking for a living, that can be a significant problem.
Well, that's fascinating, and maybe explains why on a Friday afternoon we're all so exhausted.
Yeah, exactly. And we need a nice walk in some green space.
It does work. I promise you, it really does work.
Yeah. So one of the things I found interesting when I was looking at your website was you have identified a couple of different kinds of places, enabling places and hopeful places. Can you maybe explain what those are and how those impact the health and well-being of folks that interact with those?
So I use the word enabling place largely in relation to people who maybe have some issue or problem navigating their environment. So typically I might use the term enabling environment in relation to an older person, a senior, who has a different set of needs, or a young child. But if you design an environment for a young child or an older person and make it easy for them to navigate and find their way around it, generally it's easier for the rest of us too. So I use an enabling environment framework, say in relation to older people, to think about the whole holistic physical, mental and social impact of an environment and how it can be designed to enable full holistic health. A hopeful place is slightly different, and I use the terminology of a hopeful place for really people who are in a recovery space, people who for whatever reason may find themselves in hospital or in a mental health institution, or for some reason needing some sort of intervention. And we know, again, that access to meadows, to forests, to green space can really help people heal and recover from a whole range of symptoms. It's not like a medicine, you know, it can't fix serious diseases, but it can really help with symptom severity. So kids with ADHD or schizophrenics with suffering from hallucinations, it can really, access to green space can really help those groups with their symptoms.
Okay, terrific. Can you give an example? We spoke briefly of New York and Central Park, but do you have any particular examples of cities or areas of cities or kinds of developments that are really role models for how design can support health and well-being?
So there are many cities. The one that's always cited is Copenhagen. I'm not going to talk about Copenhagen because everybody knows it's a more active living. I'm going to talk about my home city, which is Edinburgh in Scotland. And Edinburgh has many of these components of fascination. It has historic architecture. It has modern architecture. It has a whole host of green space. It has seven hills. It's called the Athens of the North. Through the centre of the city, this kind of giant lung is Princess Street Garden. So when you arrive at Waterloo Station, you come out of the city and you're met by this extraordinary garden that's been there for many centuries. So the other thing I'd say about the city is its materials. When the light, when the sun shines and hits the red sandstone that was used to build the tenement blocks, sort of 5-story tenement apartment living, this sandstone literally glows. The whole city takes on this kind of glowing kind of colour. So it's a really good example of a city that has fascination in its historic components, its architecture, its green space. I think where it needs to do some work is on its walkability. And there is a plan now at the moment to rid the centre of transport other than public transit. So it's working on that. But there are many cities that are good models. I'm trying to think of an American city. I'm struggling a bit, partly because my knowledge of America is still fairly undeveloped. So I, here in Charlottesville, where I live, I tried to live without a car for 6 weeks when I came here from the UK, and I struggled. And in the end, I capitulated. I bought a car and I'm now using it getting around. There are many cities in Europe where space is much more restricted, where there's greater connectivity between buildings, where you don't need a car. You can just cycle or walk. York in the UK is another example. Cambridge in the UK. I'm sorry, I'm citing lots of UK examples.
That's okay.
But these are cities where it's really possible to walk. It's actually more convenient and quicker to walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those. It's the action. The structure of the city leads it to being a better option. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I mean your story about moving. So you just recently moved to Virginia, if I understand correctly. And your story about, you know, holding out for 6 weeks. That's a perfect example of what I've seen is called choice architecture, and that a bunch of other decisions, you know, the system that individuals reside in influences those decisions they make. So individually, you preferred to not have a car, but all the choice architecture decisions before you arrived have led you to have, you know, almost be forced to make that decision of purchasing a vehicle, which is, I think that's one of the pieces that in city conversation sometimes gets missed in terms of the onus gets put on the individual. Well, if you're a cycling advocate, you should just get out and do it. And, but the whole system, the infrastructure and everything around it obviously has a pretty profound impact on that.
Well, that's so true. People told me not to cycle here. They said it wasn't safe. I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't cycle here. I do in Europe and back in Edinburgh where I live. So I think you're absolutely right. Choice architecture is a good way to describe it.
So if there may be lots of specific examples, and feel free to share those if you have some particularly poignant ones. But are there, what are the design decisions that have been made in cities that research shows that really have a negative impact on the well-being of the citizens that live there?
Well, it goes back to Jane Jacobs and that giving priority to traffic has such a huge detrimental effect on the life of a city.
Mm-hmm. And so just generally there seems to be an increasing amount of information as it relates to satisfaction and obesity and other health issues. That's sort of what's observed in the research as kind of the big decision that's had this ripple effect throughout.
I say so. I mean, it's not just about the impact of traffic on mental well-being, but it's the air quality issue, the noise pollution issue. Those pathogens have such a strong relationship with cardiovascular disease, with cancer, with obesity that you've already mentioned. So cities that are taking steps to limit their public traffic, their vehicular traffic, are the cities that will reap benefits in terms of health.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we've heard from a variety of folks that have been listening to the podcast, and they range from, you know, the engaged citizen that wants to contribute to making their community better, to decision makers that have some influence in how the city gets designed over time. What advice would you have for those, let's say, two audiences in particular, for how to make health and well-being more central to how we think about and make decisions on our cities?
Well, there's something really simple, I think, that cities can do, and it's called tactical urbanism.
Tactical urbanism refers to low-cost, temporary interventions in cities intended to improve local neighborhoods. These quick, affordable changes have the potential to make lasting impact.
And we did this study in West Palm Beach, and we installed a tactical urban intervention that improved access to the waterfront, improved comfort levels, shade, bamboo, reduced noise pollution to the nearby road. People, organizations like Street Plans Collaborative are showing cities how, by closing one lane of traffic or reconfigurating a crossroads, a junction where cars come together, how taking away traffic can actually really help revitalize a city. But also, I'd say this has to come from the community. You know, the people who govern processes really need to understand what it's like to experience a part of a city if you live and work there. So we talk about, in my field, this notion of co-creating research, co-creating urban design, you know, working from the bottom up, which is exactly what Jane Jacobs was suggesting many years ago, understanding the needs of your community and how small changes can actually have quite a powerful impact.
If you're interested in learning more about tactical urbanism, you can check out one of our first episodes where we talked to Mike Lydon about tactical urbanism.
Okay, well, last question we have that we ask all our guests is, can you share with the listeners a city that you love and why you love it?
Well, that would be the city I just shared with you, which is my hometown of Edinburgh. I've already said, I think, why I love that city. Let's think of a different city which has a different kind of vibrance, and that would be somewhere like Barcelona, where, again, the Gaudi architecture has this extraordinary, fascinating appeal. It's full of color, it's full of energy, it's vibrant. It's completely different to Edinburgh, but it's also very green, and it also has access to water, which is hugely important, and so does Edinburgh, actually. And providing access to water in our urban cities is, I would say, as important as providing access to green parks and green space.
Jenny's not the first guest on this podcast to say that Barcelona is her favorite city. We're going to have to produce an episode about why so many urbanists love Barcelona so much. I love Jenny's discussion about how fascination or curiosity within our environment is key for our well-being. In one of her papers, she writes about how natural stimuli, such as trees or water, can promote involuntary attention. While people are involuntarily paying attention to the natural elements, the brain can disengage and recover from cognitive fatigue. I hope as you're moving through your city this week, you can find elements, big or small, that provide you with a sense of fascination and curiosity.